Dave, what do you think the government was hoping to accomplish by bringing charges of conspiracy to incite riot during the Democratic Convention against you and the seven other defendants?
Well, despite the constant disclaimers of the judge, it's clear that the trial is a political trial. And I don't know if the government has a fully worked out conclusion that it hopes to arrive at. At the very least, it's a holding action on the government's part to try to intimidate and discourage the growing insurgencies in the country. Now, a good case can be made for the fact that it is much more carefully thought out than that on the government's part, and that it is part of a new conception of society, which the present administration has come up with in terms of the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s. That is one in which the facade of democracy will have to be somewhat scrapped, and in which the government will much more clearly proceed in the courts and outside the courts against people who are trying to assert human dignity, trying to struggle for justice either for themselves or for other members of the society. At the beginning, I think that some people thought that this had something to do with Daley's revenge, that Daley had been humiliated throughout the country, in the world for that matter, and he'd also suffered a severe political blow in Chicago, and that he had to recoup these losses by showing that the police riot, the widespread violence in Chicago at the time of the convention, was caused by a hard core of agitators who came in with this in mind. And I wouldn't rule this out as one of the elements in the government persecution. However, I think that the objectives probably go far beyond that. General Mitchell, for example, overruled most of the lawyers in his own Department of Justice when he decided to go ahead with the indictment, which means that this was, even though persecution and political repression are not new in our society, but I think that this indicates that the top leaders in the Nixon administration, the opinion makers, the decision makers, so to speak, had decided that this was a new period, and they had to go beyond the previously established norms of political repression and prosecution. Now, the simplest way to put it is that the society is breaking down. In a lot of areas of society, we're now seeing a repeat at a higher level of what happened at the time of the Montgomery bus boycott, when Rosa Parks simply could not walk to the back of the bus anymore and be humiliated that way after when she was tired at the end of a day's work. And that women, blacks, students, people who like to grow their hair long, people who like to smoke marijuana, people who are appalled at the atrocities in Vietnam, people who are disgusted with the hypocrisy and the dishonesty of the administration, that all over, and usually unexpectedly and without a great deal of prior organization, people are acting as Rosa Parks did. I think that the government feels that it's necessary to do something about this and to show that in our society, or I really should say in their society, that in their society there are limits to what people can do and get away with it. People have to get back into the role of good Germans, so to speak, taking the analogy from the Nazi period in Germany. As I see it, what they've done is rather carefully chosen a cross-section of the various trends within the movement, omitting only women's liberation. It was the taken symbol of the youth culture revolt with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, has taken symbols of the, as they would probably see it, more hardline, more political youth revolt of SDS of the past few years, with Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis. It's reached into the university academic community, the young academics, the ones who are now, in many cases, working through the new university's committees, but that the older graduate students, the younger professors and research assistants with Lee Weiner and John Freund has taken the, I don't want to condemn myself to this category, but the more traditional anti-war movement and the mass mobilizations, the organized coalition protests with myself. And then it seemed to me it just dragged in the Black Panthers by the hair, so to speak, partly because of the ardor of their desire to crush the Black Panthers, and this provided them with one other opportunity. It's taken these people and it's put them to what is intended to be the humiliation of public charges and public trial and the intended outcome of 10 years in jail. And so it's trying to say to the people in all these and other categories that watch your step. It's all right to dissent. It's all right to vote negatively or to say, to speak against what's going on, but don't take it so seriously enough as to want to change society. That's a sense, although this is perhaps a secondary aspect. It's part of the procedure of trying to channel the people's revolt back into conventional procedures which the government can handle, or which the really not so much the government as the forces behind the government, the military-industrial complex, to use the cliche, the military-industrial complex can handle.
Do you see this, then, as an overall change in the government's policy towards dissent from an era of co-option to repression?
There will always be a combination of those two factors, the carrot and the stick, the co-optation and the intimidation. But I think that it's not just the Nixon administration, although the Nixon administration has escalated, to use the current word, but actually at the convention itself, there was a decision to deal harshly with dissenters and to, protesters, and to co-opt them less and club them more. Otherwise, Daley could very conveniently, and behind Daley, of course, was the decision-making apparatus of the Democratic Party and the people who were going to finance the campaign and control many of the decisions. Otherwise, they could have decided to let us march to the amphitheater, to put on a great rally, speeches, and all the rest, and they could have said, see how democratic we are, see how liberal we are. This couldn't have happened in Moscow or Peking or Havana, but it happened here. But there was a decision, I think, to not to do that. So I don't think this came abstractly. I think it came out of the fact that dissent and protest was becoming much too widespread. And there was a decision that we simply can no longer tolerate dissent. There was not a clear and present danger in Justice Holmes' sense that the people were about to take over physically or to start a riot or to kill a lot of people or whatever it would be. But there was a clear and present danger which they were sensitive to, in that the movement was growing by leaps and bounds, that there was a real inheritance crisis in the established order because the parents could no longer count even on their own children to carry out business as usual, government as usual, American foreign policy as usual, American racial and oppression as usual.
Dave, what did the defense try to accomplish in the courtroom beyond winning acquittal, and how is this different from other political trials such as the Spock trial?
Well, I don't want to sound heroic, but I'd have to say that getting acquittal is only a small part of what we have in mind with the defense. In fact, people who have urged caution on us in the courtroom and in the countryside in our speeches and so forth, and in relation to our decision about whether to take part in other actions and to organize and this kind of thing, people who have urged caution upon us have offered a rather seductive argument that in a political trial, the thing that matters most is acquittal. and that if you get a not guilty verdict, then somehow the principles that you stand for have been affirmed. I accept this only up to a certain point, because I think that any human being and any political movement can only function insofar as it functions daily, that it actually carries out and lives up to its principles. Principles is a somewhat abstract, really, phrase or word for it, because what it really amounts to, that it's important that the dynamics of the things that you stand for be expressed and experimented with in daily life, that they grow and change and develop by being active. I mean, this starts at the most elementary level of a human muscle or organ, which atrophies if it's not used. And the same thing applies, I think, with the doubled incidents in political and moral and psychological matters. So for us to conduct ourselves during that period with the sole aim of winning acquittal, I think would corrupt us, would be disillusioning or de-energizing, perhaps a better word for it, de-energizing not only for ourselves but the people that we associate. So what we're trying to do is to keep one eye on the jury, yes, to try to actually win them over to a more revolutionary consciousness, to some sensitivity to what's going on, not present ourselves as just, quote, innocent people. We think we're innocent in terms of the law, in terms of the aims of the government, but we want to present ourselves as revolutionists, as people who believe that the forms of society must be changed. That, of course, is a long gamble. In order to present to the jury a cross-section of the movement, not only in our own selves, but in the people who come and testify for us. So we not only say, well, in Michigan and Belvo at 6 o'clock on August 28th, which is the night that the day that Humphrey was nominated, and they're trying not only to say that the police charged a peaceful crowd, but we're also trying to talk in terms of why the crowd was there, what it was trying to accomplish, some of the obligations that we felt in being part of it. Now, over and above the jury, of course, we're trying to do the same thing that the government is. That is, we're trying to talk to the movement and beyond the movement to the people of the country. The difference with the Spock trial that comes to mind immediately is that they really conducted individual defenses, and that we are conducting a group defense. I think this has strengthened us immeasurably, and it would have been easy, but I think tragic, for us to conduct individual defenses, because we're really not on trial as individuals. We're on trial as representatives, as a cross-section of the movement. And so we try to plan collectively both our responses to particular court abuses and injustices, and also the nature of our defense, the type of witnesses we put on, the order, the type of thing that we ask them to cover. Secondly, perhaps we have been a little less concerned with showing our technical innocence. Now, naturally, we are trying to get an acquittal, and we are trying to, or if we don't get an acquittal, we're trying to win the case on appeal. But our main preoccupation is with mirroring, reflecting, expressing what our very deep political convictions are.
Well, in line with this, what are the problems you have encountered in using the courtroom as a forum to bring out the political nature of the trial?
The initial problem is presented by the obsolete ritual of the court itself, which has a whole series of rules and regulations as to what one's allowed to say and what one is not allowed to say. The questions when the jury is selected relate to such things as, do they have an opinion on the case? And it seems clear to me that anybody who lived in Chicago in the year 1968 and didn't have an opinion on what happened at the Democratic trial must be disqualified from ruling on social issues. From if he says he doesn't have an opinion, either he's a liar or an nincompoop. Now, of course, in real life, people adapt themselves to the repressive or the anti-life forms of society, and so undoubtedly a number of good people have adapted themselves to that form, have been able to jump through the hoop, so to speak, and to say, well, they have no opinion and they're unprejudiced and are serving on the jury. Well, that same kind of thing extends to the rules of evidence. Although we're really charged with intent, crossing state lines with intent to create a riot, 90% of the things which show what our intent is, what our motivation is, what our mental and political background is, are ruled out. And although the judge is obviously very biased and in open court, I'm wrong to blame it all on him and not to realize that many of his repressive decisions actually have precedence in the judicial processes of this society. Now, as I've been sitting there observing this and discovering that nobody is really interested in finding out what the truth is, but only in going through some kind of an elaborate ritual, which is like the antiquated rules of the game as to how cases are tried, I've made the comparison in my own mind. It's probably an obvious one that other people have thought of before, but I must say that it didn't really come clear to me until I went through a couple months of this thing, that the American system of jurisprudence, which is, relies on what they call the adversary proceeding, is really a perfect reflection of capitalism. Under capitalism, the idea is that everybody goes out and pursues his own selfish interests, tries to get ahead of his fellows, and that somehow, well, at least as envisioned by Adam Smith, the invisible hand of God will turn this into the good society in which everybody ultimately will benefit. And in the same way in the courtroom, by the nature of the adversary proceedings and the rules of evidence which have grown up around the adversary proceeding, the prosecutor makes no attempt to bring out the truth. The defense is not really allowed to bring out the truth. All kinds of things which any sane person would know are part of the truth are simply ruled out.
Dave, how did the removal of Bobby Seale affect the trial?
That for all of us, it's changed the nature of the case a great deal because we miss Bobby Seale so much. Bobby Seale was really, I don't know how to put it, except to say he was really a constant source of inspiration to all of us. He was in jail. He was got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. He spent most of the time from 4 to 10 standing in various bullpens or way stations between the Cook County Jail and the courtroom. Yet he came in always with a fresh and creative approach. And although there was a good deal of harassment concerning our rights to meet with Bobby and to make common plans and discuss what was happening and what should happen and so forth, we did manage to meet with him on an average of an hour a day. And I must say that that has changed the nature of the case for us, the live contact with him. Now, when you add to that the brutal murder of Fred Hampton, who, next to Bobby, we perhaps had the most intimate and regular daily contact with, there's just a tremendous sense of loss on all of our parts. A very important dimension is missing, and I guess that's okay to say, but it's more than that. It's more than black-white, but it's just the whole nature of out of their experience and out of the realities of their struggle, what they had to bring into our daily experience inside the courtroom and outside it. Now, in the court itself, Bobby's predicament, being denied Charlie Gary and trying to defend himself and things that resulted from that, partly his creativity, partly the introduction into the courtroom of the whole tension between the black community and the white community, between the black defendants and the white judge. This added an element of tension and heightened drama, which is now missing. The judge now is still so completely ununderstanding of youth, of anti-war, of people who might consider that although they're defendants, they are human beings fighting a positive political struggle. His misunderstanding or lack of understanding in these areas is still colossal. But most of the scenes don't quite match the type of scene where the judge is saying to Bobby Seale, who's bound and gagged and manacled and chained at the time, saying, "Why, I have known literally hundreds of Negroes, I guess you call them black people now, but I have known literally hundreds of Negroes, and you may not realize this, but I am one of the best friends your race ever had." Well, the irony of that type of thing is missing.
Well, Dave, you have already served a lengthy jail sentence for refusing to register for the draft during World War II. In light of this experience, what are your feelings now about the prospect of jail?
Well, I guess, like a lot of things in life, despite the fact that I did spend 3 years in jail at that time, you know, besides the shorter sentences later, I guess it's still somewhat unreal to me. I tend to live, like everybody does, from day to day and from the moment's intense experiences to the next moment's intense experiences. And as I suppose all the defendants, I feel that the importance of what we're trying to do in court, even though, as I hope I've indicated, we may not have handled it as well as, you know, maybe in the next political trials people will handle it, the importance of that and of trying to react honestly and sensitively and with some kind of political perspective to the whole thing, to the whole proceeding, that is so important and so urgent and so overrules any other considerations that I guess we kind of live with that and are not too concerned. We figure that when jail comes, then we'll handle that, try to handle that in our own way also. Actually, I don't want to go to jail, and I will consider it an injustice and an example of political repression. But if I go to jail for 10 years on this charge, I know from previous experience I'll immediately be in a society, an artificial prison society, where practically everybody there, the black people, the Puerto Rican people, the poor white working class people, where 95% of the inmates and the prisoners do come from the lower classes of society, lower in quotes, that is what society has made, lower economically and so forth, the underprivileged classes, I will know that they are in there less justly than I am.
Are you guilty?
Yes.
Of what?
Of, well, having bad thoughts, because the law says that you're guilty if you have bad thoughts. We're accused of conspiracy to have intent. We're not accused of any actions. And I confess that I am guilty of wanting to see the government overthrown. You know, the judge today said that the crucial factor is our attitude. And our attitude has made us guilty. I mean, it's like, remember when the judge looked out and said, "Look at the expression on the defendant Hoffman's face? It's the expression on our faces. That's what makes us guilty, because we look at the judge with total and complete contempt for everything he stands for everything that he believes in, and that makes us guilty." I think also that we're guilty in the sense that we wanted to see a major confrontation in Chicago, we wanted to see a polarization. In the sense that we're not guilty is that we're not guilty of the specific charges that the government has produced against us. they don't know what the real conspiracy is, because the real conspiracy is a spiritual thing. And how can you put someone in jail for a spiritual crime? Because, I mean, what's a conspiracy? The eight of us did conspire. Even though I didn't even know John Freund, I was still in a conspiracy with him because we were both part of the same movement toward creating that event. And so we are guilty of conspiracy, but every single individual, every single young person in America is guilty of this crime.
So how many people do you think there are in the conspiracy?
Oh, I think that that every baby born is a member of the conspiracy, and I think that's what frightens the government so much. I mean, they actually hate us. You know, this is unlike any other criminal, criminal thing. I mean, we sit right next to them and rap to the two prosecutors, Foran and Schultz, and they have just like total contempt for us because it's two worlds. It's two worlds fighting. It's the world of one America that is dying and the world of another America that's growing up, and we don't respect their laws, and we don't respect their courts. And we're in it we're in it with our blood, and they know that, and they know that it's a that and what they get so pissed about is what they're using. We're using their court system against them. We're using the very weapons that they have perfected and turning it against them. I mean, Judge Hoffman has all the authority in the courtroom. We have all the power. He's scared of death of us. You know, we went to eat with him at the Standard Club.
I heard. Why did you explain that?
Yeah, well, see, like, I have a desire to get to know the judge, to get to know the prosecutors, to see what, you know, what kind of lives they live, what kind of environments they've created for themselves, what kind of food they enjoy, how much sex they have, how they raise their kids, how they relate to the people close to them. I'm very curious about it. The judge goes down a separate elevator and is walked by two federal marshals to a private eating place for lunch every day called the Standard Club. Now, it's interesting, the Standard Club is for Jews only, pretty much, which solves one question about the judge. We know the judge is Jewish, but there's been a heavy rumor going around that he was an anti-Semitic Jew, you know, and that denies the fact that he's Jewish. In fact, there was one rumor that he converted to Catholicism, but that's apparently not true because he eats at a Jewish club. The club's 100 years old. It's all men. Females are not allowed in. It's about a block from the federal building. And it's like, little men in white coats going around serving. So there's this businessman who invited Norman Mailer, who invited Bill Kunstler, who got the idea, why not take a couple of defendants along?
So who went?
Can you imagine the judge would have a heart attack? Here he is eating privately in his own little world, escaping from the rabble of a courtroom, and into the courtroom walk the very defendants that he thinks should be lined up and shot. Then we walked into the lunchroom. It was the total shock. Jesse Jackson ate there 6 months ago, and people talked about it every day for 6 months. I didn't see Judge Hoffman at first. Then Dave said, there he is, and in the corner, in this gigantic table that would seat 10 people, was this tiny little man in a $200 suit, old dapper Julius. And Julius looked up and turned around, and total shock hit his face. As he saw he couldn't believe it. He called the manager over. He had a hurry talk with the manager, like his marshal. You know, what's happening? What are they doing here? Why are they here? So we moved, and we started moving toward him. Julius got up, moved the table back a little bit. We got in a seat, but we still in Julius's line of vision. He then got out of his chair and moved so that his back would be toward us. We moved our chairs to another table. We'd be directly into his line of vision. And then he moved his chair back to be behind a pillar. The entire meal, he kept looking at us. Total amazement. It's just his world was caving in. I mean, as he's been saying all along, never in my 50 years of being a judge have I ever seen defendants with contempt like this. And now here we are into his eating place. The beautiful thing about it is I'll never know now whether we're going to come into the Standard Club again. There's no place he can go where he's not going to be attacked by us. So see, what the government is finding out is that you know, there's a lot of different ways to infiltrate into the society. And Julius Hoffman, you know, can never be free from our influence. After all, his kids probably identify with us. And when he hears them say a favorable thing about us, he just goes, crazy. You know, Schultz and Fram, the two prosecutors, they'd bring their kids, and we wave to them and so forth. And I know darn well that if I had a chance to talk to them, I'd have us on their side in a minute. And it's all a myth. Like, I was talking to two kids who were very close friends of Fran's family, two 16-year-old kids, And they said that in their Catholic high school, a lot of the kids say that they should be on our side, because after all, we represent youth and we're young. We ain't young. Where do you ever get the idea we're young? We ain't young. We're over 30. But it's our ideas are young. Our spirit is young. You know, everybody out there thinks that the defendants on trial are 14 years old. Dick Schultz, the number two prosecutor, is younger than I am. It's hard to do this tape because the words I say here will be held against me. Because if I tell the truth, who knows that this tape won't be subpoenaed by the government and entered into evidence. Because our words, our fucking words are on trial. I mean, anything we say now can be brought into the courtroom and held against us, even if it's 2 years after the event. I mean, I could say I'm happy a riot took place in Chicago, boom, it would be held against me. I could say riots are fun, everybody should become a rioter. Riots are the only honest occupation you can have in America today is to be an insider to riot. Everybody should become an insider to riot. That would be held against me. This trial has had a chilling effect on people's language. Because we're not on trial for murder, we're not on trial for assault and battery, we're not on trial for dynamiting, we're on trial for starting a rumor of going to Chicago, we're on trial for having an intent to start a rumor, we're on trial for having a conspiracy to have an intent to start a rumor, we're on trial for a language, for a simple language crime, the crime of saying, you know, let's all come to Chicago and have a party. So dig it, certainly people have to think twice now when they go around the country what they're going to say. And the country must really be frightened to collapse if it has to make language illegal. I think that's a good sign when a government's really in trouble and has to make language illegal. And that's what this government's doing by putting us on trial. They want to prevent people from organizing national demonstrations. They know we're going to 1972 to Republican Convention.